Good evening. James McCanny here with My Science Hour, September 6, 2012. A very interesting show. Now that the kids are pretty much, all of the kids are back in school. I know a lot of families, a lot of kids listen to this show. This is for everybody, but especially kids. I'm going to be talking about calendars and the history of calendars and how corrupted the whole topic of calendars has become. The modern twist on calendars, the Mayan calendar and all of that. Calendars are very complicated, and what we've had are a lot of amateur quacks running around, jumping up and down, that don't know anything about calendars. There are some people who have really studied calendars and have produced some amazing work. Remember a book by Lynn Rose and on calendars, and it's kind of a summary of calendar history, and because he's a person that studied calendars, and the one thing he says is that calendars are very difficult to understand, and I'm not just talking in terms of the sun and the moon and the stars, but I'm talking in terms of the history of calendarization, the making and the building of calendars. And what happens, Velikovsky was the master of calendar study. Rose was a student of Velikovsky. He studied Velikovsky, I should put it that way. Velikovsky really did not have students per se. Although you could say that Warner Sizemore, who I've interviewed, he's been on my show as an interviewee, would have been Velikovsky's student. But at any rate, the whole topic of calendars is extremely complicated. So I'll be talking the main science topic, I'll be talking about calendars. By the way, if you hear a little noise in the background, I'm not in my studio tonight, I'm actually in a very remote place in a vehicle and on the move. So just kind of a new twist on doing this show, but it's very interesting. And I'm not driving, by the way. Someone else is driving. I'm able to bring you this show live from one of the many methods I have of delivering the show from a remote part of the planet. So at any rate, just a quick note, I was going to include this in last week's show about housing. And housing in the United States has become a very distorted topic. We see modern houses and we think this is the way to build a house, and it's to code. We have books and books of city codes and building standards, electrical standards, plumbing standards, sewage disposal standards, on and on and on, and it's really been blown way, way out of proportion. Let me just start by saying that, first of all, most of us probably should live without electricity. Electricity is nice, but it's not something that it has become absolutely dependent. Second of all, plumbing and water. Overuse of water in the United States is rampant, and you can get by with a lot less water. We pour a lot of water down the drain uselessly. People water their lawns with city water, fluorinated city water. The city is pouring deadly chemicals into the water. And sewage is one thing. Every house should have its own mini sewage unit. And this is something also that's become very distorted, where the cities have taken over, or the municipalities, and the issue of sewage, of course, in an apartment building is probably not plausible. But in Scandinavia, where things are very rocky, they have a lot of rock, they don't have a lot of places to put sewage, they have toilets in every house that dispose of all of the human waste. And it's done locally in the house. And so there's a misnomer that we have to mix it with gallons and gallons of pure clean water that we should be using to drink or bathe with, and then ship it off to some place where they reprocess it all, where you pollute all of this water, send it off with great expense, through tubes in the ground to a place where they supposedly clean up the water. And then people pour all kinds of chemicals in there, which cannot be processed out, and it just adds to the absolute horrific pollution of water. But all of this could have been solved a long time ago if people just stood up and said, I'm not going to build a house like that. And it turns out, this is the crux of the matter, when you get to the actual construction, most houses today are made of frame construction, wood frame construction. It's a terrible, terrible misuse of materials. You might make the claim that, okay, it's efficient in terms you use insulation, you use block. I built a house myself once, and when I got done, there were 51 subcontractors that signed off on the building contract at the end. 51 subcontractors to build one house. And it's absolutely insane. So let me go back 100 years when people were building log cabins. The log cabin is the most efficient use of materials known today. Let's look at the big, vast forests that are growing still out in, say, the Colorado Rockies or places like that. We had vast forests just burned down this past year out in Colorado. All of that lumber could have been used. Just think of how inexpensive, if we had an efficient log cabin building business in this country. Okay, what do? You can either build a basement or pour a cement slab if you're in a place where you don't want a basement, like Florida or whatever. Okay, then you come in and build a log cabin. It's up in one day. You have an insulated wood roof, very efficient, and boom, if you want a second story, you just go up another story, or a half story is very good too. Another 4 feet with a pitched roof gives you a very nice second story, and voila, it's done. No insulation, none of that. All of those chemically ridden materials we use to build housing. And the 51 subcontractors, no. And then let's look at electricity. Very minimal electricity needed. And then a toilet that processes sewage in the house. As far as water, the pioneers were good with carrying water. I think our kids have become too, let's say, soft. You turn on the faucet and the water comes out. And it just, you can let it pour all day. You can flush the toilet 5 times and nobody thinks about it. Showers for 10 minutes, all of that. We could be doing things a lot more efficiently. And here's the end result. Okay, that might sound like economics. It might sound like all kinds of, other issues, legal issues, etc. But the end result is that we are spending vast, vast amounts of money on housing. Why not have a house that goes up in a day? It costs $20,000 or $25,000. It's a very nice family home. You have it paid off in a year or two. And then we can all start to live. Hey, what a thought. Live a normal life, communicate with our family, sit down and have family meals. No, we got mom and dad both working their tails off. The 40-hour work week is rules, and we're all working to pay interest on loans that are exorbitant. Everybody's losing their house, and it starts right with the construction of the house. So anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that. It's just my way of looking at how insane this world has become with rules and regulations, inspections, and, I mean, what's there to inspect on a log cabin? Not a lot. You look at the inside, you look at the outside, they're logs. That's it. Okay, Mr. Inspector, goodbye. Let me see. So in terms of efficiency, the most efficient housing and the most efficient use of wood, low cost, rapid construction, minimal finishing time, use of resources, very efficient use of resources, and it allows families to own their homes and actually then live a life. What a concept. Okay, I was in a storm this past week, a mini hurricane, but it was partly over land, partly over water. And the thing I want to impress on you is how small this storm was. It was a full-blown hurricane, and it was mixed with lightning, tremendous amount of lightning, and I just have to laugh at meteorology and standard science. This storm was in very frigid area. Let me put it that way. One of the more frigid areas of the planet. And it had all of the markings, and it developed over land. It eventually moved over water where I was. But the storm, oh, what a horrific looking storm. If you ever saw a hurricane coming, this was it. Like I say, it developed over land, so truly a hemicane, a microstorm. But now I just want to mention how much power is in a storm like this. And meteorologists claim that these develop over warm water. Well, in this case, there was no warm water. This developed over land, moved out over water, and continued its process. But a tremendous amount of electricity in this storm. A tremendous amount of electricity. And all of that comes from outer space, all of that electricity. I'm not going to mention a lot more about that. Of course, my weather book, all of my weather work indicates that these storms are driven electrically from outer space. Hurricanes are not driven by warm water, a concept so absurd, so absurdly ridiculous. But I still saw when Hurricane Isaac moved into New Orleans, they still talked about it picking up steam over the warm Gulf waters. You know, it's just it's ludicrous to even comment on it, because it's such a ludicrous idea that hurricanes somehow form, or that lightning forms from clouds rubbing together. Who is the guy that ever came up with that? I just have to laugh. I just want to make a quick comment on public radio. And unfortunately, I had the misfortune of having to listen to some of this week. But here's the problem. It is so owned by the New World Order. I don't know if this is a result, but a number of years ago, public radio and arts, etc., were losing funding from, and so they cried, and I don't know if they got their funding or whatever, but I love their music. Let me just start by saying that the music and the cultural part of these radio stations is immensely valuable, very good. But you get to the news, and it's, oh, gee, Mr. Obama this, or gee, Mr. Romney that, and there's the campaign going on. The thought analysis is brought by the Cato Institute, which is an ultra-conservative Washington think tank used or created to mold public opinion for the New World Order. The public radio is so bought and paid for, and the little analysis by these people, the pseudo-intellectual political analysis, it makes me puke. Excuse the expression, but I can't find a better word, nicer thing to say on the radio. But the point is that public radio, I hope it's better in other parts of the country, but it's supposed to be for the public, and this is anything but for the public. Okay, enough comment on that. I talked about the housing. Okay, I'm going to go straight into the calendar issue. I want to spend the most of the show on the topic of calendars. And I want to preface this by, first of all, mentioning that I developed a product, and it's now on the web page, and this is not an advertisement. This is more of a promotion of something that was totally missing from the, what you'd call the emergency, or not even emergency, just the normal marketplace. It's called the Emergency Survival Recalendar Portable Sunstar Clock. but it comes on a tablet, and then there are things you have to assemble, let's put it that way, when you get it. But this tablet has all the information you need to build the calendar and a clock and have it very reliable any place on planet Earth. And why is this necessary? Well, if you really understand the true history of calendars, you'll understand that calendars are, well, we live by calendars. Almost all of what we do are by calendars and by the clock. Everybody has a watch. Now your cell phone is your clock and calendar. But going back in history, in 43 BC, Julius Caesar established the calendar, the same one that we use today, but they did something very interesting. They extrapolated that calendar back to around 4300 BC and said, this is the calendar that goes back in time and that will go forward in time. And so every now and then that calendar has to be adjusted a little bit because of quirks in the number of days in a year, the number of times the Earth spins around in one complete year, etc., etc. But to extrapolate that calendar back to 4300 BC, approximately 4300 BC, I'm starting to think that way back then, the people in power, the cult groups that were monitoring and managing the world through wars, taxation, and banking, it's what it was going on back then, the same issues, but that led into the Middle Ages and leads up to the same type of imperialistic country that we have running today in the United States, that were they trying to destroy the public knowledge of calendars, the history of calendars at that point, basically by decree, moving the calendar back to 4300 BC, when in reality they knew that the calendar had changed, the people, I'm talking about the people in power, that they knew that the calendar had changed around 1500 BC. And it changed because, as Velikovsky has pointed out, and by the way, Velikovsky was studying calendars. He started out by doing an esoteric study in New York. He was he started this out when he was much younger. He was a curator for a while in one of the museums in Israel. He was Russian by birth. He knew Einstein. He lived in Germany. He knew Einstein before they came to the United States. And then around the late 1940s, he became very interested in a topic, and he was at Columbia University in New York, in New York City. He was trying to find a timeline on calendars because something very strange. If you understand calendars, you understand that historically the world had had a lot of problems with calendars. And as I said, Julius Caesar established the calendar in around 43 BC, and then we count from the birth of Christ, BC, birth before the birth of Christ, or AD, after the death of Christ, that's the reckoning of our current calendar. So you can see those are pretty major events in history that established our calendar. That's what we go by. And of course, this was carried through by the monks through the Middle Ages. You might call them the Dark Ages, but these groups maintained calendars throughout all of this time to keep us on time, so to speak. And so at any rate, the issue is historically with calendars that, okay, let's flash forward here a little bit. Flash forward to about the year, about 300 AD, when the Roman army went into England, and there was an abbey in England that they wanted to destroy. It was the remnants of the library of a guy named Joseph of Arimathea. Joseph of Arimathea was the great uncle of Christ. He left Rome. He was a rich business. He was a rich Roman businessman, uncle of Mary, the mother of Christ, and he had a tremendous library. It is also believed that he took the cross with him, and it is in England, in some hidden place. But at any rate, the point is that the library was in the Abbey in England, and it became under attack. It's where the books were kept, and eventually, okay, so let me continue with the story. The Roman army came in with the purpose of destroying an area. It was an area in England that was defended by the local Celts, and was an area where the Roman army never wanted to go. But they were given an assignment, and their assignment was to burn down the abbey. And so and that was including the library. So the people who, the Chaldeans who were in charge of the abbey and the library, took the books, put them in wagons, and got most of them out of there. And then the Roman army came in, did its job, and burnt down the abbey. Then the people, the Chaldeans, went back and picked up the burnt remnants of that and brought it. Eventually, those were put into hiding, and I won't go through much of the rest of the history of that. I don't know how much I'm free to expose to the public of what exactly happened. But the end result is that in the about the late 18, the late 1980s, a group of the people in who were still carrying on the tradition of those books and texts started putting them together. And I talked with the woman who was in charge of doing this work, and what they wanted to do is a compilation of the books that were in that treasured, a lot of them burnt remnants, etc. That book they named the Colbrin, K-O-L-B-R-I-N. And that book is available from the Chaldean Trust. It's available at Goody's Bookstore. It's in Australia, and you can find a link to that. It's the only link I have on my webpage. I don't link to other websites. It's just a policy that I've had, and I've kept that. But the only link that I have is because I feel it's so important that people out there read the Colbrin. And I want to make you aware, too, that the Colbrin is about history, and it's about calendarization and the rebirth of man and the rules of living prior to the great disaster. That's when Venus came through the solar system, and there were many big comets in the solar system at that time. So the point is that the Roman army was sent in to destroy those books, and it's my belief they were sent there because the people who have been controlling this planet that go back way back into history, that go back to the Egyptians, and that keep the public down, it's the same group of people, that they wanted to destroy the history so it never got back to the public. There's a great philosopher, historian, who once said that if you destroy the history of a population, then you destroy the population. You can control them. You can enslave them. And that's what's going on today. That's what public education is all about, kids. You go to that school and you learn what they teach you. There's a whole formula that they're teaching you to enslave you and to rob you of your true history so that you don't know what your history is, where the people came from thousands of years ago. I had an experience one time in Florida. There was a history teacher, and she had taught history in the Florida public school system for decades. And I was flipping through the history book, and of course, eventually I went to the beginning of the book, and I looked in there and I said, where's the part about the great flood, about Noah, about the great moments in history, about Moses? And she goes, oh, we don't teach any of that. That's all fairy tale. The most important events in the history of man are not included in standard history. Why? Because they want you to think that man became man in the little valley in Mesopotamia in, 7000 B.C. and all of the races of man evolved from there. And they destroy all of the history of man. So the point is that when the Roman army went into Glastonbury Abbey to burn it down, then the point was to destroy the history that was held in that library, because that history was available to the public. And that's something that they did not want the public to have, the availability of records that show the true history of man, including the issue of comets. And so the Colburn, by the way, I just should mention, I always have to mention this when I talk about the Colburn. If you search on the internet, there's a imitation fake book that some quack imposters showed and have copied parts of the Colburn and pretend that they're the authors. Don't buy it. It's on Amazon. It's if you were conned into buying that book, send it back and get a refund. The real Colburn is available from Goody's Bookstore in Australia, and you want the original. It's a gorgeous, big, hardbound volume, worth every penny of it. So go to my webpage, scroll down. You'll see the link to the ChaldeanTrust.org. And go there and you'll find, order it. It's a book that you should have on your coffee table. Read it from cover to cover. But the very beginning talks about the great comets of old, the comets, the big comets that rained through the solar system and destroyed man. The reason I became involved with the Colburn, in fact, my second major book called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, introduced that book to the American public. And I was the recipient of one of the three first copies that came into the United States when it was first distributed. I know where the other two copies went. And they specifically asked that they get a copy to me. I got a copy, and the reason was they wanted to interpret what that book really meant. And so I looked at it and I thought, my goodness, this is an amazing document of the ancient huge comets when man was destroyed. And it gives a graphic detail about the man and the destruction of man and the rebirth of man. There were two such events from great comets, and there were multiple big comets in the solar system at one time. But that's not the point of this show. I'm talking about calendars. The point is, then way back in history, around 1500 B.C., and this started around about 4,200 years ago, probably around 2000 B.C. to 2500 B.C. was when these big comets first started coming in. And if you look at the history of the Egyptians, they claim that there were many of these throughout their history. One of them, the Sumerians, talk about Nibiru. There's a lot of what I call misinformation now talking about a 3,600-year period for Nibiru. Well, the 3,600-year-ago time frame was when Venus, the comet, came through the solar system. And it looks like about 600 years earlier, around 4,200 years ago, was when the comet Hale-Bopp was in the solar system. So it was my estimation that Hale-Bopp and Venus were here around the same time. And oddly enough, Hale-Bopp at that point had a Earth-crossing orbit. It had an Earth-crossing orbit when it came back in. But going back to the issue of calendars, the calendars radically changed around 1500 B.C., and this was what Velikovsky was talking about. This was the entire body of Velikovsky's work. So when astronomers attacked, well, not only astronomers, geologists, evolutionary biologists, when all of this massive conglomerate of academia attacked Velikovsky, It was on a basis of astronomy and geology, all saying that no, Earth has been here all this time, nothing major has happened, forget about it, go home, don't look at this guy. But the point is that Velikovsky was studying calendars, and he noted that back at that point, the calendars had changed radically. The biggest change was they went from a 360-day year to a 365-day year, and it took them hundreds of years to sort this out. Not only were they struggling for survival and trying to struggle just to basically find food to eat and live, but this is also corresponds with the Moses event. The Noah event was thousands of years earlier. The Bible, the ancient text, the Old Testament, is primarily a documentation of the Noah flood and the man that existed prior to Noah, then the great devastation flood that destroyed Earth, which was obviously a vast comet. Earth passed through the comet tail. And then thousands of years later, the lineage in the Bible goes down, and there you have Moses and the Israelites in Egypt, and that's when Venus came through. That's the Moses event. If you want to hear more on the details of this, get my 18-hour CD, and it talks about the ancient celestial disasters. But tonight I'm talking about calendars. So around that 1500 BC time frame is when the calendars change. So you have to look at the Julian calendar. Why, and they didn't have to do this, why did they go back 4,300 years and extrapolate the Julian calendar backwards in time? That had nothing to do with the calendar, the Roman calendar, or the future of the calendar, but they wanted to establish that that calendar had been good for 4,300 years into the past. I believe that they were trying to destroy the calendar, so the public never asked again about calendars. Okay, so at any rate, now let's come forward into what is a calendar. After a while, the solar system pretty much stabilized, Earth stabilized in its new orbit. Before that, Earth had a 360-day year. That meant that the Earth spun around 360 times in a year. And it would be very odd if that were exact. So there would always have to be some kind of correction. Today, the Earth spins around 365.2466 times per year. So that's about 365 and a quarter day per year. Okay, so every 4 years, every year there's a quarter day extra. So what happens? Well, we just kind of forget about that quarter day. We adjust our watches for the mean solar time. That's the amount of time for the sun to rise and become noon again in the sky. The highest point in the sky, so to speak. And the midpoint between the two, the rising and setting horizons, where the sun rises and sets. But our watch time is actually an average time, because as the Earth goes around in its orbit around the sun, it gets closer to the sun at some times and farther away. The closer we are to the sun, the faster it moves. But the Earth doesn't spin any faster. So what happens? That day, it takes a little longer for the Earth to spin around and for the sun to become the highest point in the sky. So some days are longer than other days. When Earth is farther away from the sun, the Earth is moving slower. So the Earth spins around and it gets to the point where the sun is highest in the sky a little bit sooner. So the actual solar day is shorter. Okay. So let's break down the current year. We have, and by the way, there's kind of a misnomer that the moon is used to build calendars or is involved in calendars. It has absolutely nothing. The moon is not used at all in building calendars. We roughly associate the moon, because it has a 28-day cycle, We roughly associate it with the months, but it's always cycling off. In fact, there's a term called blue moon, once in a blue moon. Blue moon is when you have the two full moons in the same month. And so that's a rare event, but it does happen sometimes. So once in a blue moon means not very often. That's a common expression that we use. But the moon is not used at all for calendarization. What we use for calendars are the cycles of the sun. We divide the sky into sections, into 12 sections. And so this actually goes back to the Babylonians. And what happens is we then divide the year into 12 months. And so as the earth goes around in its orbit around the sun, we see different parts of the night sky, and that, and also where the sun lies in the constellation on the far side, on the sunward side. These define what they call the zodiac. These are the signs of the zodiac. So the zodiac is not related, some voodoo science or whatever. It simply has to do with calendarization. Astrology was the first astronomical science. They wanted to measure exactly where the Earth was, to develop time, to develop calendars. And so astrology preceded astronomy. Astronomers today like to laugh at astrology because they think it's voodoo science. The astrology was the original astronomy. If it weren't for astrologers, astronomy would be nowhere near where it is today. Astronomy takes a lot of its terminology, a lot of its measurements. Astronomy takes a lot of its information and early development from astrologers. And just a quick note on astrology. In the mid-1990s, when I was working with Russian scientists, atmospheric scientists, in a university in Novosibirsk in Russia, the psychologists there were doing studies trying to find if there was a basis for astrology, an astrological a science, a basis. And when they heard of my work from the atmospheric scientists, they became very interested, and what they realized was that the astrological significance, the significance of the planets, planetary alignments, etc., that was empirical in astrology, actually had a scientific basis, because what was going on, humans were reacting to the electric field alignments of the planets and moons, especially our moon, the sun, other planets, etc., Mercury in retrograde. All of these things had an effect on people, and this had been observed empirically prior to that, but they established the fact that astrology really does work. There is something to astrology. I'm not talking about the astrology little blip that you get on the internet every day or the thing you read in the local newspaper. I'm talking about there's really a scientific basis for astrology. The human influence, the influence on human beings by planetary alignments. And that has to do with what house you're in. Why does being born on a certain date at a certain time influence you? Because that's based on where the planets were at that time, and the electrical connections that one has with the signaling from those electrical currents that are in the solar system. You can actually read and sense those. We are also connected electrically with the planet we live on. Okay, so at any rate, back to calendars. Looking into the current calendar, we have 365 and a quarter days. Every 4 years, 365 and a quarter days in a year. So every 4 years, we have to have a leap year to account for that quarter day every year. So every 4 years, there's a complete extra day. Every 100 years, we do not have leap year, For example, in the year 2000, we did not have leap year. Why? Because leap year was on the 100-year mark. Then there's a 1,000-year correction. And people who keep time are constantly adjusting this so that we end up having a correct timepiece. Okay, so what happens if a big object comes through the solar system and disrupts our planet? Well, what happens is all of the calendars are going to be off. All the clocks are going to be off. I got a kick out of somebody. I said I didn't have this new product, and it's to recalendar and redevelop timepieces in case of emergency. And this person holds up a beautiful Rolex watch, a beautiful, you know, $1,000 Rolex watch with the calendar and everything. He says, well, that doesn't bother me. I've got my watch. And I said, no, you don't understand. Your Rolex watch is going to be absolutely worthless. I mean, it'll be a nice watch, and it'll tell old Earth time, but after a pole shift, after an encounter with a massive comet, if we live through one of these things, then your watch is not going to be accurate. It's not going to tell anything about the real time, because the Earth's time and calendar is going to be completely changed. So what I went about doing is I said, okay, what we need, and if you look at all my books, The Diamond Principle, if you look at the Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, or the Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes books, or the weather book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, or my Calculate Primes book, or The Diamond Principle, or this calendar, or the 18-hour lectures CD, 2 CD set. All of these items are unique. All of these items are very necessary knowledge, and it gives you a basis for understanding how the world works. The calendar, the latest item that I have on the webpage, okay, let's look at what it does. It allows you, with a tablet, you take it out and you either look at the stars, you set it up for stellar observation, or you set it up for solar observation. You can use either or both or a combination of both. The instructions are included. It gives you all of the information about how our solar system works today. The planet Earth revolving around the sun, the solar calendar, the zodiacal dates, where the initiation dates and the end dates of the zodiacal zones, the 12 zones of the calendar. And all of this in a very simple format. It gives you a chart, a graph on adjusting for mean solar time. In other words, so you can adjust to your watch time, and it gives you a couple other corrections to adjust for solar time versus watch time. Because if you're not exactly, for example, if you're not exactly in the center of your time zone, then your sunrise, sunset, and noon times are going to be offset by a little bit. I think it's a minute every 4 degrees that you're away from the center of your time zone. Or longitude adjustments, latitude adjustments. There's adjustments that you make on this, but on a single board from any place on planet Earth, including the southern hemisphere, you can determine that the clock, the sun, the star clock, the etc., or the sun clock, and combine them. And then once you've got it set up, you have a timepiece and a calendar that works. And also there's a little calendar device on there that allows you to project out and build calendars far out into the future with great accuracy. So it's a really important device. And additionally, in 10,000 years, when archaeologists come and discover our destroyed race, either a Planet X destruction or who knows, we die off because of some government-devised microbe that they release or leash onto the public in some form of insanity, and the archaeologists come and discover our civilization, these boards will be all over the world, they're going to discover them, and be able to build our calendar so when they read our history books or interpret information from our history, they're going to be able to build a calendar. Now that's a luxury we did not have. So when Velikovsky sent out to rebuild the calendars, he really didn't have anything to work from that they left us other than signs and indications. What he did is he went around the world and he established what dynasty, what kingship, what monarchy, what royalty was in power at the time of the Venus event, when the comet came through the solar system. Eventually the Venus comet became the planet Venus. But that event, that major event when it came by Earth, establishes the new point where the new calendar begins and the old calendar died off. Our old orbit, our old orbital parameters, all went by the wayside, and we don't have any record of what it was other than the fact that we know that there were 360 days in a year. We also know Mars had a very different orbit. This object came near Mars and greatly influenced the orbit of Mars, pushing it much farther out to where Mars is today. So what happens if one of these events happens in the future, or a natural disaster and man dies off or whatever? It allows the future to rebuild our calendar. The other thing is that if people survive, the one thing they're going to need, and this is the most important reason why I released this new calendar product, is because as people try to survive, they need a calendar, they need a timepiece to make decisions. Say there's a pole shift. Let's say you're living in New Jersey, okay, or you're living in California. And there's a pole shift. Okay, so people somehow, there's some survivors. If you're in New Jersey and all of a sudden you've moved closer to the North Pole, you have to understand this. This device will allow you to measure the pole shift, the physical pole shift of Earth. And then you might have to decide, well, gee, we're too far north. We're not going to make it up here. We got to move south. But then you have the question, you're going to be in the middle of a winter, you'll be coming out spring on the other side, and then all of a sudden, like, what day are you going to move? What day are you going to make your move? If you go on the first nice sunny day, that might be February yet. And all of a sudden you start to move all your people and your belongings, and you get caught in a big blizzard. If you knew that, like, April 15th would be a good day to start moving, that's when the snow will be breaking, that's when you're pretty much guaranteed as you move south, you're going to have clear weather. And let's say at that point you realize you're going to have to move 1,000 miles south. Well, how are we going to do that? How much provisions are we going to take? That's a lot different than moving 100 miles south that you could do in a number of days. So you need a calendar, you need a timepiece, and all of this requires, your major decisions require information. It requires you to have a time and a calendar. So the whole purpose of this calendar, recalendar, star, sun, star clock, is to allow people to build their own timepiece. And it's very educational for kids. If you build this, you're going to understand a lot about the sun. And if you have your parents get one, you're going to understand a lot about how calendars work, about how the sun works, about how your watch time is different from the sun time, and how to make that calculation. It's fairly quick and easy. But if you don't know how to do it, it's not going to make a lot of sense. In fact, you probably won't even think about it. But I think it's important too. The other thing that this tablet contains, by the way, is all the information on our solar system today, on the orbit we have, the orbital orientation, and all the details of Earth orbiting the sun. So if there's ever a major pole shift or change in our orbit again, future generations can rebuild our particular calendar. It can rebuild where Earth was, and it actually starts on in 2012. It shows the basis in 2012. And so into the future, all future dating would be built on 2012. Well, what happens if there's a major Earth change? Well, at that point, societies would have to decide where to begin their calendar, just like Julius Caesar did in 43 BC. Where do you put the zero point to start marking the calendar? And it was a major accomplishment of government. In fact, they still call it the Julian calendar today. But it's readjusted for the epoch of the year 2000. The calendar is a very, very important piece of our lives, the calendar in sun clock. Sun clocks, you find sun dials, you'll find all over the world. So people have been keeping track of calendars all over the world. But let's say, what if there was a pole shift? What if there was a pole shift? It would not give you all the information about where Earth was at the time or what our orbit was. They're incomplete. Every sundial on Earth makes one basic assumption, that the Earth and its movement around the sun is going to be the same for all points in history, past and future, into the future. That's not necessarily true. If there is a pole shift, if there is a problem, so the existing sun dials of the Earth are made with the assumption that the sun and the Earth are always going to be the same, but that's not the case. That's why the product that I put out is different. It allows you to, first of all, understand our current calendar, the one we have now, and if there is a pole shift, well, what's going to happen? How are things going to change? How are things going to change in the future? And how can you rebuild the calendar? If you understand how our calendar works today, then you will understand how to rebuild it and the timepiece in the future. You will simply rebuild what we have, what you find on this calendar clock. And it could take a number of years or a decade for all of this to sort out. But remember that the ancients didn't have this benefit. They didn't understand what was happening to them. They didn't understand why the calendar was different. That's why when I talk about pole shifts and I talk about comets and the fact that how this physically works, you understand that Velikovsky didn't have any theoretical work to base his calendars on. The reason he had a big fight with the astronomical world is because they thought they were smart and he was some kind of radical nutcase. The guy was so intelligent, so far ahead of his time, and the astronomers were so boneheaded, so cloistered, so myopic in their vision that they still think that they're correct. They don't understand that, for example, some of the best examples, when, for example, you see mastodons frozen in the tundra, these in Siberia, and these are animals that lived in a temperate climate and lived on vast plains. They required vast amounts of food, and they're dead, standing on all 4 feet with undigested tropical plants, flowers, delicate flowers in their mouth that digestive juices in their mouth would cause these flowers to disintegrate in minutes. How could an animal like that be found thousands of years later, to the point where the meat was so fresh that the workers on the Siberian Railroad ate it for lunch and shipped it off to France as a delicacy? The animals did not fall over. They didn't die and then fall over. And then, they were standing on their feet. They were alive while they were flash frozen with 20 feet of tundra building up around them. How did this happen? How could such a thing possibly happen? Well, that was the pole shift. What was the old North Pole, the old Laurentian ice cap, or the old Laurentian ice shield, was the old North Pole. And so in that same process, now my pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, in the middle there's some diagrams that describe the before and after Earth, after a pole shift. And it describes how the Earth actually, the mantle and the crust of the Earth slide over the core because there's a viscous layer there in between, and how it slides over with the gravitational wave of the passing comet, and the central core keeps moving in the same direction. So then after the top, the central core stays spinning in much the same direction, it's kind of like a soft-boiled egg. If you spin a soft-boiled egg, the outside shell spins, but the inside doesn't spin. So if you spin it on a table, it stops spinning very quickly. It goes back to normal. I want to summarize this conversation by just, especially to kids, have your parents get you one of the calendar devices so you can set it up. Keep track of daily time throughout the year. And it's going to be a very informative process. And I waited to do this show until kids were back in school. Everybody's out for summer, running around, having a great time. But now that you're back in school, I want all the kids out there to get one of these calendar devices and keep it. This is something not just for a school year or a quick school year project. This is something you're going to have not only for the rest of your life, but it's something you'll hand down to your kids and their kids if we last that long, and if any of them are ever unlucky enough to have a major pole shift, then they will have the device that will allow them to survive. So at any rate, calendars, it's central to our lives, calendar and time, and this device allows you to correctly build a calendar and a clock if you do not have a calendar and a clock. And even in a normal emergency, time and calendar would be quickly lost. I don't care how good a Rolex watch you have. Many things can happen to a good timepiece to cause it to have a dubious credibility, let's put it that way. So at any rate, make sure you go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and all of the information is there, including mail order. Make sure that you get one of these, and if the price is $39.95 for one unit, you can get two of them. I think it's $79.90. You get two of them, plus, and that includes free shipping, or if you buy $200 worth of any combination of products, you get the calendar free. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the